You're listening to Sex Gets Real with Dawn Sarah. That's me. This is a place where we explore sex, bodies, and relationships from a place of curiosity and inclusion, tying the personal to the cultural, where you're just as likely to hear tender questions about shame and the complexities of love as you are to hear experts challenging the dominant stories around pleasure, body politics, and liberation. This is about the big and the small, about sex and everything surrounding it we don't usually name. The funny, the awkward, the imperfect happen here in service to joy, connection, healing, and creating healthier relationships with ourselves and each other. So welcome to Sex Gets Real. Don't forget to hit subscribe. Hey, you, welcome to this week's episode of Sex Gets Real. I am Dawn, your host, and I am so excited to share my chat with Tristan Taramino for this week on the show. Now, I have to just warn you, when Tristan and I get going, we get going. So our original plan was to get together to talk about this amazing memoir that she's working on, all about her early life. And there's so much richness that you're going to hear because we do talk about that for the first like 25 minutes or so. But then we started talking about ableism and changing bodies and pain and what Tristan's geeking out about right now, which has to do with whiteness, which led us to talking about the sexuality field as a whole. And 90 minutes later, we realized we should probably wrap this up. But then we hopped over and we did like a 20 or a 25 minute recording for Patreon all about triangulation in poly relationships. So you are getting a whopper of an episode with me and Tristan Taramino today. But before we get to that, there's something really important that I want to take a couple of minutes to take up a little bit of space to talk about, because it's something that we need to really be paying attention to. A piece came out a couple of days ago on Medium called "Dill Don't Disrespect Black Femmes: Our Personal Experiences with Wildflower Sex Shop." Now, Evian Whitney has been on the show before, and Cameron Glover, who are both contributors to this piece. There are also four other people who have contributed to this piece, and I'm just going to use the names that they shared in the piece to respect what they've chosen. So Ashley, who a lot of you probably follow on Instagram, at Ashley Chubby Bunny. Carmen Knife, who is at Lisa Spliffson on Instagram, and LaShawne, who is at LaShawne on Instagram, nice and easy. And then Venus Cuffs, who's at Venus Cuffs on Instagram, plus a shop called Unbound Babes. Now, this piece is really, really important, and I am going to link to it so that everyone has a chance to read it. I shared it on social media last night, but you can head to sexgetsreal.com/EP272 for episode 272. And I have a link to the piece right at the top of the page so that everyone can check it out. It's really, really important. And so let me just share with you a couple of little snippets of what they wrote. So this is their language, their voices, but I want to create a little bit of space for all of us to hear this. One of the things that they collectively wrote in the piece is, we ask that white sexuality professionals stand alongside us and uplift our stories as valid, sharing with their networks and condemning harm to Black femmes with the same energy they demand from us in support of their own endeavors. So I'm going to read a couple of little snippets that I've pulled out. Most of them are the ones that they've already highlighted in the piece to really bold the importance of, but there is so much more to this piece than what I'm sharing here, and it's important. It's important for all of us to really think about not only the harm that's being caused and the ways that we position ourselves within sex positivity and sexuality movements and other movements as well, like Health at Every Size and so many others. But it's become so damn easy these days for us to take up stances that we then become almost religious about. And often when we think we're taking this moral high ground, we're actually reinforcing really violent systems. You're going to hear some of that unfold in a couple of these snippets. So let me just share their words. And then I'm actually going to share some really wise words from Tristan to continue the theme of the day, which is Tristan. And then we'll jump into my juicy, delicious talk with her. So Evian Whitney writes many things in this piece, but I've got three little snippets I want to share. The first is about Wildflower Sex Shop. I literally felt like they had used me and discarded me when I could be of no more use to them. Evian goes on, I do not understand why I am the target of Wildflower's anger about my choice to work on this particular campaign. You'll read more about Evian working with a company around people who have low desire. And so Evian goes on, why aren't they directing that anger at this pharmaceutical company? Don't they understand how incredibly hard it is to make a decent living in the sexuality education industry? Perhaps they don't, as two able-bodied, femme and masculine presenting white folks with lots of resources and privilege. Wildflower has no right to pass judgments on me for trying to make an honest living doing the work that I do, especially when, in the two times I've worked for them, my compensation for them was way lower than what I am worth. So this is one of the things that I really want to highlight for us to all go check this piece out and think about where we're directing our anger when we're making stances, right? So it's so easy to get angry at individuals, to vilify individuals, to kick individuals out, to not give them second chances, when often where our anger really needs to be directed is at the systems and the institutions that are causing the harm. And inside of a system like white supremacy and capitalism, where none of us are really ethically existing anyway, for someone like a Black femme, like Evian and the others that are a part of this piece, to be trying to make a living, which is exceedingly difficult to do sometimes in sexuality, especially if you exist at certain intersections of marginalization, like if you have visible disabilities, if you are poor, or if you're a Black femme or a queer trans femme, right? Evian also writes, I also ask that folks question the ethics of a company that blacklists Black femmes for their decision to make living wages in an industry that is still working hard to be taken seriously and be respected. Ashley of Ashley Chubby Bunny writes, fat Black women are not supposed to be having sex, let alone enjoying it. And if you're queer on top of that, you might as well just hope someone loves you, quote unquote, enough to deal with your greedy ass needs or is, quote unquote, desperate enough to look past them. I'm not supposed to center my needs, have them met, or even make them known. So me doing what I do is important. And then Ashley goes on, but I do not appreciate being caught in the violent crossfire of a privileged white person using Black femmes to do their dirty work and punishing us if we don't. This is beyond textbook white feminism and something that I do not feel like being a part of, as the problem Wildflower Sex has with Unbound. And Wildflower should not be trying to stop Black women and femmes from being able to pay their bills because they did not appease the owner of Wildflower Sex by doing what they tried to get us to do. What Wildflower Sex has done and is continuing to do is violent, and in the grand scheme of things, continues to reinforce the system of whiteness that protects those that benefit most from it, even when they are actively oppressing others for their own benefit or leisure. So what you'll hear about in this piece is Wildflower Sex Shop, who is an online sex shop, who partners with a number of different people, including the Black femmes that are a part of this article. And then tries to strong arm them into doing certain things on their behalf while underpaying them and underappreciating them. And then when the Black femmes that are in this particular piece make decisions that Wildflower Sex doesn't agree with, Wildflower Sex then tries to get them removed from panels, get them fired, outs them and or blocks them on social media, all deeply harmful behaviors. Tristan took this piece and then wrote on it, and I think that it's so important what she wrote. So I'll link to that as well in the show notes and at sexgetsreal.com/EP272. Tristan says, "Hi, white people. Please read this, circulate it, and reflect on it. This is a painful but also illuminating example of how white supremacist capitalism is working exactly as it was designed. Please read these accounts. If all you read is my white lady analysis of them, you're valuing my voice over the voices of POC. So please, please go read this piece and really reflect on the behaviors." But what Tristan goes on to say is, "What I do find useful to share my thoughts about is some of what's at play here, because it illustrates how white supremacy plays out on an interpersonal level. One, Wildflower folks frame other people in the sex toy space as competitors and adversaries, which is classic capitalism. But they made no public attempt to call in these quote-unquote bad actors. Instead, they used women and femmes of color to conduct an orchestrated whisper campaign which would ultimately benefit their company. Think about how easy it is for us to do those things on social media." Two, Tristan goes on, "People in the sex industries rampantly continue to ask, in quotes, for unpaid labor, exploit sex educators, and devalue our work. And this happens most often to people of color and other marginalized folks. Three, it's unacceptable for white sex educators and retailers to use images of Black women and femmes to bolster their optics of being inclusive without doing anything to fairly compensate the people whose images they use or address structural inequalities under white supremacy. That's also something I really want people who are entrepreneurs, who are sex educators, to think about. It's tokenism if you're using images of Black bodies and disabled bodies and fat bodies, but you aren't putting your money where your mouth is. If you're not donating to organizations who are fighting for justice, if you're not paying the artists, if you're not paying people that you're working with, if you're not actually contributing to change to undermine the system causing the violence, then it's tokenism that ultimately benefits your brand or your business, and that's just not acceptable." And then four, Tristan closes, "This is a clear example of when white people police how Black women and femmes do business, their values, who they partner with, and how they make a living. This policing has the built-in assumption that everyone comes to capitalism on the same level playing field, and to the assumption that white people know best who is quote-unquote good and who is quote-unquote evil, and that our values trump those of people of color. Both assumptions are steeped in white supremacy." You're going to hear Tristan and I go some really interesting places in this conversation, and we do talk about whiteness in the sexuality field and how it impacts each and every one of us and the ways that we experience pleasure, the ways we inhabit our bodies, and so much more. So I think it's really important for all of us to sit with this, but please, please, please go and read the piece, "Dill Don't Disrespect Black Femmes, Our Personal Experiences with Wildflower Sex Shop." So again, that link is going to be on the show notes and also on the website for the show so that you can check that out. And let's really have some hard conversations with ourselves around the ways that we're treating people who have experienced and continue to experience ongoing violence and oppression. So let's shift over to my interview with Tristan, which is super fun. You are about to get an earful. For those of you who aren't familiar with Tristan Taramino, which would frankly be shocking, let me read you a little bit from her bio because she has done some stuff. And then we will go right in to this juicy, meandering, beautiful conversation we have. Tristan Taramino is an award-winning author, columnist, sex educator, speaker, filmmaker, and radio host. When she was 24 years old, with little publishing experience and even less capital, she founded Pucker Up, a magazine of writing and photography dedicated to sex and gender, and was responsible for every aspect of the 64-page publication, from editing and marketing to sales and distribution. She's the author of 8 books, everything from 50 Shades of Kink, An Introduction to BDSM, to The Big Book of Sex Toys, The Anal Position Guide, Opening Up, A Guide to Creating and Sustaining Open Relationships, something that I recommend all the time on the show, Down and Dirty Sex Secrets, and 2 editions of The Ultimate Guide to Anal Sex for Women. She's also the co-editor, along with 3 other people, Celine Perenyes Shimizu, Constance Penley, and Mireille Miller-Young, of The Feminist Porn Book, The Politics of Producing Pleasure, which is fantastic and on my shelf. She also conceived and edited the groundbreaking collection, The Ultimate Guide to Kink, BDSM, Roleplay, and the Erotic Edge, which I share all the time with clients. She's the editor of 25 anthologies. Her books have sold over 500,000 copies and been translated into many languages. She has written for a multitude of publications. For 9.5 years, she wrote a biweekly column in the Village Voice. She runs her own adult film production company, Smartass Productions, and was an exclusive director for Vivid Entertainment for a number of years. Tristan's taught hundreds of classes on everything from negotiating relationships to female orgasms. She's also the host of Sex Out Loud, which is the number one show on the Variety Channel Voice America Talk Radio Network, where she has a weekly sex show that also is a podcast. So wherever you listen to this podcast, you can also find Tristan's show, Sex Out Loud. And she's the creator of the Sex Educator Bootcamp, which is something that I helped behind the scenes to produce. So for all of you out there who are thinking about becoming sex educators, Tristan's Sex Educator Bootcamp, which is an entirely online training program that you can participate in, is something that I highly recommend checking out as a jumping off point, and so much more. So you can learn all about Tristan at puckerup.com and at tristantaramino.com. I, of course, will have the links in the show notes and at sexgetsreal.com/EP272. And also, just a reminder, I now have transcription for every single podcast episode. So if you are someone who is hard of hearing, or it's just easier for you to read, you can head to each of the episode pages for the show and get the transcript. Sometimes it takes a week or two for those to come out, because it does take many, many hours to transcribe the show. So huge thanks to my team for helping me to do that. But if you need a transcript for any reason, then the last like 20 or 30 episodes or so have transcriptions now. So you can go get that transcript. So check that out. And here is my conversation with the amazing Tristan Taramino. Welcome to Sex Gets Real, Tristan. I am very excited to get to talk to you this morning.
Me too. It's been a while.
It really has. I have been missing talking to you and geeking out with you, and I'm really looking forward to
this. Same, same.
So here's where I'd love to start. You are working on a really cool new project that's like kind of new to everyone, but I know you've been thinking about it for like many, many, many years. And that is a memoir, a very personal memoir. And I'd love to hear a little bit about that. Like, what's coming up for you? What are you writing about? What's next?
Yeah. You know, I have been thinking about it for a bazillion years. So this memoir is basically about me growing up and coming of age, also coming out as queer and growing up with a gay dad. My parents were divorced when I was young. My dad came out as gay. And then there was a lapse in time where I didn't have any contact with him. And then I started to have contact with him again. And we had this really intense, really close relationship. And right after I graduated from college, he was diagnosed with AIDS, not HIV, just to be clear. He was diagnosed with full-blown AIDS, and they thought he'd probably been positive for about a decade. And he died about a year and a half later. So the book covers my upbringing, my college years, and what it was like to when I found out that my dad was gay, and then what it was like to be one of his primary caretakers as he was dying. Mm. And it's really, really hard. I mean, first of all, I've never written a memoir. I mean, I've written about personal experiences, obviously, and I've written first person stuff a lot, but I've never delved into this particular genre. And so it's way outside of my comfort zone. It's like if someone called me and was like, hey, why don't you write a book about orgasms? I'd be like, yeah, let's do that. that feels like so much easier and so much, I'm just more familiar with it, right? It just feels like I could write a sex how-to book pretty, it would be pretty straightforward. And this is like nothing like that. And there are days when I would rather do anything than write about this stuff. It's really emotional for me and it's really intense. I started my Patreon. It's really interesting because I started my Patreon kind of for two reasons. And one was like to get support and feel like someone was there kind of like hanging in with me as I knew the process was going to be really emotional. But also my Patreon has allowed me to have to do the work because my patrons expect an excerpt, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's been this amazing accountability process for me that I like set up for myself, which is that now I can't disappoint people. And so even when I'm like, I don't want to do this, I'm like, but you have to because your patrons like signed up for this and you said you would.
Damn it.
So it's been an amazing motivator to keep me like really on track because it's such a kind of amorphous thing. There's no quote unquote deadline. There's no one checking my work. It's such an internal process. And I feel like the Patreon has made me just be more regular and consistent about my writing practice.
Did I read right that part of this process includes you reading things that your father wrote?
Yes. So my father wrote a lot. He wrote a play. He did a lot of poetry, and he wrote a memoir, which I have a hard copy, a physical hard copy printout of. It was never published. And my idea right now is to incorporate his story and my story together. That how that shows up in sort of form is still kind of up in the air. But as I read his memoir, one of the things that strikes me is, first of all, how radically different our experiences were around gayness and queerness. And, you know, it took him 20 plus years to come to terms with his identity. And it was really fraught with a ton of homophobia, internalized self-hatred, all the messages he got. I mean, it was very, very intense and hard for him to come out. And in contrast, it's like a generation later, I'm in this super supportive place at Wesleyan where I went to undergrad. And everyone around me seems gay. And I've grown up my whole life with gay people in my life. And it just wasn't the stigma, the shame, it just wasn't there. So it's fascinating to see kind of how that can shift just in one generation and within the same family. And then also there are these patterns that get repeated. You know, I feel like my dad had a really rough childhood growing up and really wanted to be like, okay, I will never like do that to my own kid. And I will never create this kind of atmosphere of a lot of emotional abuse and verbal abuse and just, you know, unresolved mental health issues with his mom. And so But as I read some of those experiences and then look back on my experiences I had with him, my relationship with him could be very volatile and intense. And a lot of stuff gets repeated. And you only have, you know, you only have the perspective on that once you see his story and then see my story alongside it. So there's a lot of stuff there. And I think also we were ultimately kind of searching for the same things in our lives, and these things of like a sense of home and a sense of security kind of eluded us both. Mm. It's really intense shit.
Yeah. It sounds really like special and intimate and hard and confronting and kind of like all of these really intense things at the same time.
Yeah, you know, so because I have the hard copy, what I do is I type up, I'm retyping so that I have an electronic copy of the memoir. And I got to the part in his memoir where he meets my mom. And it was way more emotional than I anticipated. I mean, I have a sense of how they met and the circumstances and of their relationship. And reading it from his point of view was just really hard. And then I felt like I'm at a point now where I've actually put it down, because part of me is feeling really anxious because I know how that particular part of the story ends, which is with him leaving me and my mom when I was a baby, basically. And so I haven't been able to pick it back up because I know where it's going. And it's right now, it's just too hard to go there for me.
Yeah.
I will eventually, but.
Yeah. So when you think about your timeline and like your kind of coming into a sense of your own queerness and your relationship with coming out and like learning that your dad was gay and becoming a sex educator, like, how does that timeline kind of fit together? Like, where does it begin?
Yeah, no, that's a really good, interesting thing. I was just talking to someone yesterday and I said, you know, I'm writing this memoir, and they're like, oh my God, do I ever want to read Tristan Taramino's memoir? You know, and with this look of glee on their face. And I said, actually, I've got to tell you, this book only goes up till the point when I'm about 25. And so the next memoir, which I have already sort of been planning in my head, there will be a lot of sexiness, a lot of kink, a lot of public sex, a lot of just wild, wild, wild times. But they're not really going to be in this book. Not that you don't see the seeds of maybe who I am now and who people know me as, but truthfully, this book starts when I'm born and goes up until my father dies when I was 25. And, you know, looking back, like, I feel more sort of like sexually new and naive than anything else. I really do. I'm like, wow, this is not the swinging from the chandeliers territory. That actually comes later. It does. It comes later. Yeah. So like I haven't made a porn movie yet. Like I haven't written my book on anal sex yet. Like I haven't, this book really is encapsulated by my father's life and death.
Yeah.
So stay tuned for memoir 2. It's going to be amazing and is going to tell you, you know, spill the tea on all the things that I've done. And if you think you know all the things I've done, just imagine what I haven't written about and what I've saved for a memoir. It's like bananas. But this one is about, you know, coming of age, about exploring sex as a young person, exploring desire as a young person. It's just the beginning is what it feels like. It's the very beginning.
What are you hoping when people read this really like tender personal memoir, their kind of like main experience or takeaway is going to be?
I mean, I think it's interesting to see the kind of origin of people. You mm-hmm. know, when people ask me, so how did you get to be who you are? I essentially begin my story in college. College was like life-changing in a profound and amazing way for me. And I feel like I began to plant the seeds and become the person I am today in college. So when people say, hey, how did you get to be a blah, blah, blah? I'm like, okay, so it's the 90s. I'm at Wesleyan. And I tell the story from there. And so I feel like people have heard parts of that story, but no one knows like what came before that, mm-hmm. right? They don't. I mean, people really don't know that much about my upbringing, my childhood. And so to return to your own origin story and kind of see where you've come from and how that has kind of shaped and influenced where you are today, it's a really fascinating process. And it's fascinating like what you remember. I mean, that's the other thing is that, you know, I feel like I am not at the height of my sharpest memory. I'm 48 years old. I'm in menopause. My brain feels mushy sometimes when I wake up in the morning. Mm-hmm. But I do have a lot of, I have notes. One of the great things that I have is I have a lot of stuff. I wrote letters to him and he kept them. So I have those. He wrote letters to me and I kept them. So I have those. I also found a series of letters that I wrote to my mom while I was spending the summers at his house. And so I have some documentation like from during the time, which really helps to kind of spark memory and put you back in that place, you know, which is really interesting. But the origin of just where I've been and where I've come from, it's just, in some ways it feels like so far away, but then you, as you write it, you begin to see these pieces of yourself that started early. They started really early, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And so I feel like I'm interested to see what people think of my origin story. And also, I want people to really see this trajectory of how life has changed. It's for a very particular kind of white person, white, cis, queer person, mm-hmm. who's essentially middle class. My dad didn't have any money at all, but he had an advanced degree. And both my parents struggled with money as I was growing up. But they had very middle class sensibilities, you know? Mm-hmm. So I feel like I was raised middle class. And it's just, it's amazing just how much all of the work that folks did in coming out in the 70s and the 80s, when it wasn't safe, when it wasn't cool, when it wasn't on TV, all that sort of led to a totally different environment for me to come out into.
Yeah.
And I just don't know that there's that many like father, daughter, queer memoir stories out there. Apparently we have stories of people who are queer and one of their parents is queer too, but I don't know that we have that many of them.
Yeah.
Because there isn't like this idea of even being a second generation queer person is like those second generation queer people are now grown-ups essentially, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's interesting, you know, like Alison Bechdel has this great memoir called Fun Home. She also had a gay dad and we are about the same age. So there's a lot of similarities I see in there, but also a lot of differences because her father was closeted and my father was out. So,
yeah. This project sounds so emotionally exhausting, but also just like, I don't know. There's something in my heart that's just like, oh my God, what an amazing project to get to read all these letters and to like re-remember and to connect dots from his perspective. Mm. And, you know, just kind of like the filling out of this 3D model. You know, sometimes our stories are kind of two-dimensional because we've made them into something mm-hmm. for ourselves to make meaning. And then to be able to read his memoir and then have this new depth, it sounds really, I don't know, like important, but scary and hard and the kind of thing you're going to look back on in like 20 years and be like, fuck, that was so important.
Yeah. And just hard. I mean, it just, I feel like there's still so much emotion wrapped up in it. I feel like if you haven't lost a parent when you're young, it's hard to explain how the feelings can be entirely like right on the surface for me mm-hmm. when it's, you know, it's more than 20 years later. And the grief still can spike in these ways that are totally unexpected. I can burst into tears at any time. It doesn't follow any kind of pattern. And also, I think that there's a second layer of grief that I've experienced. For example, I went to a conference on GLBT health stuff, and I heard, you know, a bunch of speakers. I mean, this is kind of my job, right? And one of the speakers was talking about specifically about palliative care and end of life care. And she gave this talk. Her name is Kimberly Aquaviva. You should have her on the show.
Great.
So I saw her speak. I really loved what she was talking about. I thought she was really smart. I was like, okay, I'm going to follow her on Twitter. And then I followed her on Twitter and I found out that this person who's an expert in GLBT health and specifically doing really good work around palliative care has a partner, a life partner who's dying. And she is documenting her dying process daily on Twitter.
Wow.
So, which you can imagine is like really intense. I mean, just really intense. And they have a son together and he is, I think, I'm going to say he's around 18 or 19. I think maybe he's younger. And it's like both beautiful and also tragic, right? It's tragic. But at the same time, like, they're honoring this process in such a deep and meaningful way. And recently they have like a GoFundMe, and recently the son wrote a letter and posted on a GoFundMe about his experience of one of his mothers dying. And it was like so beautiful that you just wanted to weep for hours afterwards, right? And especially because he's definitely under 20, right? So he's like not even that old for him to grasp all these ideas. And so there's a part of me that feels like I had no role models for how to experience dying and death. I didn't have any adults around me who were competent or empathetic for various reasons. Mm-hmm. I had no one to guide me through the process. I had no one to help me make meaning of it. I had no one really. It's like if I could do it all over again, I feel like I would have done it differently.
Yeah.
But I was in my 20s and, you know, I'd never lost anyone before. And there was no one around to kind of say like, hey, Tristan, you might want to think about this, or you might want to do this, or they're really, those folks were not in my life. So I grieve that when he died, like I don't know that I was even fully present. I was even in my body when he died.
Yeah.
And when I see people going through the process of death and doing it in such compelling and thoughtful ways, that's hard for me because I don't feel like I have this like beautiful death story to share. Mm-hmm. It was really overwhelmingly painful, and the aftermath of his death was painful, and leading up to his death was painful. There wasn't a lot else to it.
Yeah. Is there some element of writing this memoir that's allowing you to kind of have some type of ritual around that grief story?
I mean, certainly spending a dedicated amount of time every day with him in a very intentional way is a new experience for me. You know, like I feel like in the movies, people are like, oh, so like on Sundays, I go talk to my dead parent at their grave and it's so meaningful. And, you know, representations in the media. And, you know, my dad does not have a grave site. He was cremated. I have his ashes. They're in my house. They've moved with me probably, I don't know, 6 times. They've moved across the country with me. But I don't know that I've had a daily relationship with my dad in the way that I have now that I've started this book, where I'm looking through photographs, I'm looking through letters, I'm taking myself back to places and trying to remember like what was going on for me at the time. I'm in some cases checking in with my mother. You know, my mom is going to be 79. She's real sharp. And so there are some fact checking things that I can actually do with her in terms of like timelines and locations. And that's also an interesting process with my mom, who I don't have, who I have a pretty fraught relationship with, that's just kind of getting to a place where I want to be. Mm-hmm. So it's, yeah, so spending this daily time with him in some way, it feels like its own kind of healing.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm really looking forward to reading this.
Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I hope people find it interesting. I don't know. You know, so that, I mean, I think that there, you know, everyone has like imposter syndrome. And yeah. I remember talking to my therapist about it actually. Like she was like, what are the blocks around even writing it? And one of the blocks around writing it is like, who the fuck cares? Mm-hmm. Like you're just this like white middle class girl who had some trauma and some sadness, but like didn't get over. You know, there are people who have made strides in their lives and have overcome trauma that is unimaginable to many of us, like unimaginable. You're like, I can't believe that you're still here and here and thriving, right?
Yeah.
I don't feel like that's my story. I feel like there were things growing up that didn't work for me, and there are ways in which I felt alienated and definitely emotionally isolated. But so part of me is like, does anyone even care? Like, does anyone even care about this story? It's hard to center yourself and think this is going to matter to someone else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, I don't think when I started it, I thought for a minute there would be as much class stuff as there's end up being. Like, I feel like we have these writers who like write about class and they sit on panels and talk about writing about class. And I don't know that like, I thought my story was like steeped in class issues, but I do feel like it's emerged as a major theme and one that I'm like constantly reminded of. So that's been kind of a surprise.
Hmm.
I think I thought at the center of it were these issues of sexuality and sexual orientation. But when I go back and see the pieces sort of come together, there's a thread through it around these like class struggles in terms of the community I grew up in being more wealthy than where I was. And the idea that like my parents had these middle-class values, but they didn't have these like middle-class bank accounts.
Yeah.
So there was always a kind of struggle, financial struggle and tension. And then also a kind of a striving and a there's a lot of aspiration in my young years of seeing people around me with a certain kind of wealth and really wanting that. And again, not being able to put that in words even remotely. You know, I feel like you know, I had a crash course in class, and it began when I was 8 years old, when I began riding horses and sort of getting a view of this world, this very wealthy world of people who competed and were at horse shows. And I didn't know it at the time, and I couldn't articulate it at the time, but it's like, it was so clear in this particular world what class was and who had what and what it meant for their value as human beings.
Yeah.
And I was internalizing all of that at the time without any kind of processing or anyone saying, hey, this is what class is in America.
Yeah.
So that was kind of, that's kind of been really interesting to go back over.
Hmm. That echoes a lot of my upbringing as well. That's interesting. Yeah. Well, I'm ready to read it. That's all I'm going to say. I mean, I think like, I think one of the things that I'm hungry for, and that I'm seeing a lot of the people that I work with are hungry for, is stories.
Mm.
You know, like not, here's the three steps to make $50,000 a month, or
right.
I quit my day job and I'm in Bali, you can too kind of stuff. But like, I want to be with people in hard, complicated things. And I want us to feel less alone in those things. And part of how we feel less alone is in being with each other's stories and witnessing them and feeling the togetherness where there's similarities and also feeling that difference and like allowing it all to be true. And this sounds like such a beautiful project.
And I think that feeling of not fitting in, whether it's around class or race or sexuality or gender or age or ability or body size. I mean, it's religion. I mean, all of those things. Like, I do feel like every kid feels alienated on some level. And that was my experience growing up, that I didn't quite fit in. I sort of fit into a lot of different groups, but I didn't 100% belong there.
Yeah.
And that's also a kind of interesting thing to think about, how we negotiate feeling alone when surrounded by people, basically.
Yep.
And also just examining the kind of like the sex positive roots of my life. You know, people are always like, how did you get to become you? And I think people imagine I grew up in a super liberal household, or I grew up on a lesbian feminist commune, or somehow I got some like early programming around sexuality that was like different from what they've had. And the truth is, like, I went to public school and I grew up in a small suburb, and I didn't get any sex education when I was a kid. But I'm going back and sort of seeing places where I feel like in really subtle ways, my mom eradicated sexual shame from my life. And that has had like a major imprint on who I am today. I mean, there's part of me, there's people want to know, like, why are you shameless? How are you shameless around sexuality? Right.
Yeah.
And I'm beginning to see like the pieces of it just in contrast to other people's experiences. You know, like when I ask people, especially I ask people about like, when was the first time like your parent caught you masturbating, like out in, not in public or like in the house, not in your bedroom, and what happened? You know, to me, that's like a really pivotal thing, right? Because it sends you all these messages about like touching your body, being sexual, experiencing pleasure. And people have these freak outs, right? Where they're like, oh my God, stop that. And like the parents freak out, and it's like everyone freaks out. And then people are like, okay, I shouldn't touch myself ever, right? That's the message that they get, because it's like it's their child brain.
Yeah.
And so I have a pivotal experience where, you know, I was at my mother's friend's house. They were having a dinner party. I was in the living room watching TV. I started to masturbate, and my mom came over and she was like, hey, so this looks fun. I know you really like doing that. We're at someone else's house and they haven't, you know, they haven't agreed to like be a part of that. So why don't I take you somewhere where you can shut the door and do it in private?
That's amazing.
And to me, like it's like barely a memory. It's literally barely a memory. But then when I go back to it, I think, oh, this imprinted on me pretty early that I wasn't doing anything wrong.
Yeah.
And that then built this foundation of no shame around bodies and around sex.
That's extraordinary.
And by the way, the house where I masturbated was this two gay guys. They were French. They were very good friends of my mom. They were amazing cooks. And so then there's this other piece too, which is that there have been gay people in my life since I was born. And that's before, way before I knew my dad was gay. So that was also a thing that was like a regular, the fact that people were gay was just totally normalized in my family. It just was not a big deal. Like when someone said, we're going over to this couple's house to do something or other, right? Either my mother or my father. I just assumed it was two people in a relationship. I had no idea what their genders were, and it was seemed irrelevant, actually.
So, in other words, you are every conservative's worst nightmare and proof that being around right. gay people will
makes you gay.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and also for the people who are like it's hereditary or it's DNA, I also reify that model that like my dad's gay and so I'm gay and right. I think it's a little I think it's more complicated than that, but also I went to like the gayest college on earth. Just note to people who are, you know, who are young listening to this or thinking about going to college, Wesleyan is super, super queer. It just has that reputation. But I didn't know that when I was in high school.
Yeah.
So I ended up there almost by accident. And then I can't imagine ever being anywhere else. So, yeah.
Because it set the groundwork for here today. Yes, it did. Tristan.
It set the groundwork for sure.
Well, as you've been working on your memoir and doing all of these other amazing things in your life and having conversations with amazing people and teaching workshops, what are some of the things that you have really been like sinking your teeth into and geeking out about lately?
Well, tomorrow I'm about to start this 4-day intensive conference called Unmasking Whiteness.
Ooh.
It's put on by this group called Aware LA, which is essentially an affiliate of Surge, which is showing up for racial justice, and is built around the idea that anti-racist white people need to educate and empower other white people around their anti-racist practices, and that there are times in which an all-white space is created so that people of color don't have to do the labor yeah. of educating white people about race or listening to their shame or their, you know, awkwardness or their stupid questions or as they work through their own, you know, internalized racism. So part of what I feel like in sex ed, you know, this sort of thing happened, which was way back, I don't remember what year it was, but when this Sex Masters book came out and it was all white people and people of color very prominently stood up and like called out white people in the field of sex ed. I took that call very seriously and I began to reflect on, okay, why are there only white people organizing this conference? Why are there only white speakers? Why are the keynotes always white, right? And so on an institutional level, on a macro level, I began to think about, okay, every time I think about presenting somewhere, I have to figure out if they've thought about racial justice.
Yeah.
But then I feel like there has to be a secondary piece of work, which is super personal and internal. Mm-hmm. Right. So I feel like some people are like, oh, I can get in line here. Let's see. I need photos of people of color on my website. I need a person of color on the organizing committee. I need some person of color presenters. I need some person of color contributors to this book. Okay. Yeah. Diversity. I got it. And that is first of all important. It's practical ways to enact your politics, right? It's ways to sort of walk the walk and not just say we're inclusive, but actually take steps to be inclusive. But then underneath that, we have to come to terms with, as white people, our own racism, our own legacies of white supremacy, mm-hmm. how we uplift and uphold white supremacy on a daily basis, how we benefit from it, how we turn the other way and pretend it's not happening. So I feel like I've moved into a place in the past year with the help of this great organization, Aware LA, where I've done more of the internal work of dismantling racism in me.
Yeah.
And then that it feels easier to try to go out in the world with a different lens and seeing things in a different way when the internal stuff is fueling it.
Yeah.
Rather than the kind of piecemeal, oh, right, I should be thinking about race. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I feel like that's something that I feel like I made a commitment to myself to do and am sort of actively working really hard at, sort of baking it into the pie rather than sort of like putting the ice cream scoop on top.
Right.
Why I had a pie metaphor, because you know I'm hungry, that's why. So it's all about food right now. So like really having a foundation, and I think you can't do the external work effectively, mm-hmm. or with true intention and empathy if you haven't done the internal work of your own racism. I'm racist. I grew up in a racist society. I'm a white person.
Yep.
It feels really important to me. And like I said, it was kind of spurred on by these, you know, these awesome people of color in our world, in our sex ed world, who said, yo, like, wake the fuck up. And some of us did, and some of us still haven't, but I hold out hope. I just think I've made a commitment to it. I've made a commitment to having, you know, a large percentage of my guests on my podcast be people of color, marginalized folks, underrepresented folks. And I have to think every day, what am I doing to dismantle this system?
Yeah.
But you can't actually explore that question if you haven't explored your own internalized values.
Right. And if you're not working on it every single day.
Right.
Right. Because the default is, as soon as I stop working, I'm complicit again, because the system is mm-hmm. built to make it easy for me.
Right.
To forget.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's one of the things I'm finding that's really important to me. And then I'm just like thinking a lot about, and also how to put these things into practice, how to develop practices so that I have like a go-to list of like, these are the ways I'm going to enact these politics on a daily basis.
Yeah.
I'm not just going to say it. Here are the ways that I'm going to do it. And here are the ways that I'm going to, you know, use my platform, not, you know, drop the mic, hand the mic off to someone else. Like all of those things, like you have to take into consideration, especially once you have achieved a certain level of visibility and a certain level of power mm-hmm. in the world, right? I'm not powerful on the level of like, I'm a congressperson or whatever. I have this sort of micro power within this community to make change. And I feel like it's my duty to use that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of the things that I found to be true, and I'm curious to hear what you found around this too, is like the deeper I go into one system of oppression, the more deeply I get ingrained in all of the systems of oppression. So like the racial work leads me to like anti-fat bias, which leads me to disability justice, which leads me to classism and capitalism. And like the dismantling of white supremacy fundamentally means the dismantling of capitalism, colonialism, patriarchy, you know?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I just was on Disability After Dark with Andrew Gerza.
Oh, how fun.
And, you know, I think in my own struggles with my body, with chronic pain and a number of other things, I felt more and more that when we talk about accessibility, we have to think about it from literally every angle. Who is this accessible to and who is it being excluded from it?
Yep.
And to me, accessibility, when you say accessibility, people are like, oh, you mean like wheelchair accessible?
Right.
And I'm like, that's literally one of 100 things that you have to think about. True accessibility is about like who can access this and who can afford it, who's going to be comfortable once they get there, who can get to the place. And so, yeah, all of these things begin to intersect and you begin to see the intersection points. And you also begin to see that I do feel like every day I notice more and more like how capitalism really sets us up to fail and really fucks us up.
Yep.
It's like, it is set up for us to work ourselves into the ground and yet never actually get the payoff. There are people working themselves into the ground right now who don't even have a living wage.
Yeah.
And I feel relatively financially secure. And yet I feel like capitalism continues to fuck with me because I'm not in the 1%. Like the 1% people are running around right now having a pretty great time.
Yeah.
And the rest of us are, you know, I feel strongly, very strongly because of all of my interactions with the healthcare system that I am one healthcare crisis away from being in financial disarray.
Yeah.
Just one. And I have health insurance and I'm educated and I can pretty quickly advocate the bureaucracy, the paperwork, all of the bullshit that goes around with accessing healthcare. I think I can be an above average advocate for myself, which not everyone can do. English is my first language. I can work the system to the extent that I can, and yet I still feel like at any point everything could collapse over one hospital stay, one big operation, one health crisis.
Yep.
Which is terrifying.
Yeah. It's terrifying. And I think one of the things that I've been grappling with personally is like how, as I become more and more aware of how like fragile this state that I am in now, right? Like one health crisis, like you said, away from, you know, there was a article that came out in the paper yesterday here in BC that surgeons in British Columbia are so fat phobic and they think fat people are so subhuman that they've stopped operating on them if they have a certain BMI, regardless of their metabolic health and all the other things, to the point where the government is now offering more money to the surgeons who are willing to lower themselves to do surgery on fat bodies. And so like one of the things that, you know, I've been grappling with is literally, if I end up in the hospital,
You get competent care?
Well, I get competent care. And if they are paying someone extra money to do surgery on me that no one else will do, what's the quality of that care? Because they're going to be able to then turn around and say, well, that person was in a fat body. And we've all proved that fat people are horrible and hard to take care of. So it's not my fault. Right. And so just like those kinds of things. But like how many people have been lost before this and how many people can't even access that kind of care? You know, I mean, it's just like, I think the scope of these issues can feel so terrifying. And I think that's one of the reasons why people then shut down and like, not my problem. Right. Because
well, and grief. Also why people who are marginalized in various ways don't access healthcare.
Yep.
Don't go to the doctor. Let things go for a while because they're afraid of walking in and being, it's literally the opposite of being harmed in the place where the first rule is do no harm.
Right.
They're afraid of walking in the office. And the first thing that they're going to hear is like, forget all this other stuff. It's your weight.
Yeah. Right. Or why didn't you come to see us 6 months ago? Right. So this is your fault, even mm-hmm. though when you come in, we're incredibly hostile to you. You know, it's like the ways that it's been proven over and over and over again that doctors will discredit like Black women's pain.
Mm-hmm. Women's not, pain across the board.
Right. Black especially pain. Like Black and Indigenous women. Right.
Yes.
And just like, yeah, just the systemic level of harm that's occurring. And like it ties deeply. And I think this is one of the things that I've struggled with. I've lost a lot of listeners over the years to this too. Is like this stuff impacts our sexuality directly.
Yes.
And so we have to have these conversations if we're talking about and teaching about sex, because if I have untreated pain, if I can't get care, if I have to work three jobs, that impacts my ability to be fully sexually expressed and to be treated as a human being.
Well, access to pleasure, it's like the idea that we have unmitigated access to pleasure is a myth.
Yes.
The idea that like sex is quote free, I'm just going to put, of course it's in capitalist terms, by the way, that there's right. a cost or a value. But the idea that like anyone can have sex and have good sex or satisfying sex or sex that makes them feel whole is bullshit when so many folks are marginalized in so many different ways that all of that counts towards how they can even access pleasure.
Yeah.
I want to tell you that I went to the doctor recently and then I got a bunch of paperwork back. And so for the first time in my life, my BMI has now reached the point where I am considered obese. I'm basically between a size 10 and a size 12.
Yep.
And it was like there in black and white. It was like they just handed it to me to be like, you're obese.
Yeah.
And I was like, wait, what? I'm sorry. You know, and so like these seem entirely random. And at the yeah. same time, because I'm a certain size, I think people also make assumptions about my health, which are usually wrong.
Yeah.
Like I, you know, I'm in good to fair health most days because of my pain and because of other issues. Like, you know what I mean? But if people see me and see that I have a certain body type and they're like, oh, well, she's relatively healthy. It's like actually not true.
Yeah.
But they make these assumptions like based on how I look.
Yep.
Which I think is also really fucked up.
Yeah. And that's like baked into all of our desirability politics, which also yes. ties back to relationships and sex, right? Like whose bodies are we valuing and whose bodies are we discarding and or putting way lower down on the privilege scale? Usually for completely and like totally uninformed reasons, right? I'm going to look at you and make a decision about whether or not you're worthy because you have a certain size and your hair looks a certain way. And there's like, there's not a further analysis beyond that. It's just, I like what I like. I want to challenge those things. I want mm-hmm. us to do better and dig deeper.
Well, and also the idea that you're interacting with a society. So on a daily basis, like you walk out in the world, right? You go see your doctor, who's fat phobic, among other things, racist, doesn't take your pain seriously. Then you go to work where people are talking about dieting uh-huh. and their diets, and people are telling people they look really good because they've been on a diet. Then you turn on the TV and we've got like airbrushed, beautiful. I just saw a Project Runway where one of the models was so gaunt, was so thin that it made me uncomfortable. You know, and this is like a successful model, right? Who's in Fashion Week and who's walking the runway. Okay, so so it's like you're absorbing all of this stuff, and then you get in bed with someone and you're supposed to be like, okay, let's go.
Right.
I'm 100% in my body. I'm fully present. I'm feeling great about this.
I'm chill.
I feel empowered.
Right.
You know, I feel 100% body autonomy. I feel 100% confident in my yes and my no. It's not possible.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
Nope. And that's part of what makes the work so exciting to me. But I think also challenges a lot of people. You know, I think there's a lot of people out there who are just like, but I just want it to be about sex. And it's like, but all of this is about sex. And that mm-hmm. to me feels really rich and like enraging and motivating and interesting. And, you know, like we're talking about deep human needs and impact. But it has to be more complex and nuanced than just insert A into like slot B and yay, we've talked about sex.
There's this really thoughtful article. I had the writer on and I'm totally blanking. She is a burlesque performer. I totally follow her on Instagram. So I'm going to look it up right now. She's a burlesque performer, but she also for years and years worked at a sex shop, right? And she wrote this one of the best pieces, I think, about working in a sex shop that sort of went beyond the, oh my God, you'll never believe what people say. You know what I mean? Like that, you know, that kind of just, God, I feel like Kitty is in her name, but I can't. Okay. Well, you'll have to follow up on that.
Yeah, I will.
So she wrote this article and about her day-to-day experience. And she was like, you know, ultimately, can I sell you a vibrator? Yes. Can I tell you the benefits of using lube? Yes. Can I say that you have to warm up for anal sex? Yes. But there's some fundamental things here that I can't change in our interaction, like the relationship dynamic between cis heterosexual people. The fact that one of you didn't want to come to the sex shop in the first place, mm-hmm. but you're obviously there and not 100% into it. The fact that your partner just dismissed this out of hand as something that was like way too kinky, but maybe I saw a spark in your eye that maybe you actually thought, no, I think that actually might be fun. You know, like she would observe all of these things that were so much deeper. And then it was like, you can leave out the door with a vibrator, but this is not going to solve these fundamental things that I can see are going on. And until these gender dynamics are examined, and until shame is lifted, and until these certain practices are destigmatized, and until you work through your own issues around sexuality in your body, like this vibrator is only going to do so much. It was just a really thoughtful article, and I loved it. And that's, it speaks to that, right? Yep. It speaks to that, that if someone comes in and you feel like one of the partners is not, doesn't even want to be there.
Right.
How do you say, I'm going to improve these people's sex life? Because you know deep down, you're not.
Yeah.
And you know deep down, you can't solve the problem on the spot in a retail environment in 15 minutes.
Or even, you know, by writing into the podcast, which I adore. But so often, so many of the questions have these deep underlying issues.
Right.
Right. And so we have to have some different kinds of conversations before we can even get to the stuff that you really want, because we can't just jump there without also acknowledging the emotional labor that maybe is happening and hasn't been talked about for 20 years or 1,000 other things.
Well, also, the more and more I read people's questions, the more I'm struck how there is a series of assumptions built into the very question.
Yeah.
Like I remember I was talking about to someone recently about, they said, like, I want to know, like, I want to ask women, does size matter? So I'm just going to ask them the question, does size matter? And it's going to be like a yes or no question.
Right.
And I was like, okay, actually, can we time out on that for a second? Because when you're saying, does size matter, yes or no, I think you are assuming that what you're asking is, do you want a big cock?
Yeah.
Do you need a big cock? But if you ask me the question, does size matter? I may answer yes. And what I mean by yes is, there are some penises that I can't fit in my vagina. It's just a fact. It's my geography. I've also never had children, and there are penises that don't fit in my vagina. It's not even about comfort. It's not even about pleasure. Forget pleasure. Right. It's not comfortable.
It's just not going to happen.
No matter the lube, no matter the warm up, it's painful. And I don't want to have painful sex, right? So if you ask me the question, does size matter? I would say yes. But then are you assuming that I mean I want a big cock?
Yeah.
Because I'm answering yes. And then if you followed up that question, I would actually have a lot of things to say.
Right.
But built in, baked into the question is, does size matter equals big, big?
Yes.
Big. You mean, you're not saying what you mean. You know what I mean?
Right. And I think what also is baked into that question, which I think folks who have been like assigned female at birth and who have moved through the world, maybe being assumed to be a woman and or who identify as women, you know, I mean, like when someone asks a question like that, in my head, I'm thinking, no matter what I answer, their story is going to override the answer. Mm. Right. So if I say, no, size doesn't matter, are you sure? Because I've had people reject me for this before. Mm. Right. Or, yeah, size matters. Okay. Well, what kind of size? Right. And I mean, like, there's this gymnastics that's going to start happening because the direct conversation, we don't have the foundation for a direct, honest conversation to happen where grief can be present and we don't have to fix it, or where, you know, like all these other things are at play. It's like they're anticipating the response already to the different answers I might give. So we're not even having an honest exchange.
Right. And so, and that was the other thing. I felt like the premise of the question was so much more complicated for me. Like, cause that's the other thing. It's like, so I'm having sex with someone and they have a certain sized penis. Does it matter? Well, it matters insofar as if that penis is going to be in me.
Right.
But like, would I reject, like, so would I reject someone wholeheartedly because of their penis size? No, because I have a more expansive view of what sex and sexuality is. Yes. So to me, does size matter? Yes. Physically for me, it does. But it doesn't matter in the way that you're thinking it does. And it doesn't exclude the possibility that I'm going to be sexual and I'm going to have a satisfying sex experience or sexual ongoing relationship with someone irregardless.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like there's all these layers that don't get talked about. It's kind of like the sort of trope of the women's magazine, right? It's like, right, if you master these four positions, you're going to have the best orgasm of your life. For me, if I have really good chemistry with someone, if I can let my guard down, if my body is cooperating with me, if I haven't taken pain meds, if I'm as present as I possibly can be in my body, if I have the right kinds of stimulation, I can probably have an orgasm.
Yeah.
That's what contributes to my ability to have an orgasm.
Right.
But a position, that's not actually what it is.
Right.
There's so many factors for me that go into the chances of me having an orgasm. And none of them have to do with like the way that you flick your tongue. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the way you treated me before we got here, before we got
here. Yes.
And it's like how drawn to you I feel. And it's like how in my head I am. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's so many pieces here that can't be, that have no easy fix.
Did I eat something delicious today and I feel resourced?
Or do I feel bloated?
Right. Yeah.
Do I feel bloated and actually like uncomfortable in my, below my waist?
Yep.
Right?
Cover that, Cosmo.
can I let go of work? Yeah. Can I stay connected to the other person? Can I stay connected to my own body?
Yep.
All of those things that's the meat of it. You know what I mean? Yeah. Those are the things that I feel like I'm contending with and grappling with when I'm thinking about how can this sexual experience feel good and satisfying, or how can it be orgasmic? I also am someone who, you know, the older I get, the more I have really incredible sex without an orgasm. And, you know, people still look at me sideways when I say that. They're like, you're saying that because you're like a sex educator and you have to say that, but that's like not really true. And I'm like, actually, it is.
It is.
It is. There are times when I feel entirely holistically satisfied. And the orgasm just wasn't in the cards.
Yep. I wish for more people to discover that place.
I know. But if you told me like I would be 48 and in menopause and having the best sex of my life, I would tell you were absolutely bananas. Like I would never, if you hit me at like 28 and said that, I would be like, no. Did you see what I just did? I'm having the time of my life.
Right.
So I didn't see that coming. I'll admit I did not see that coming.
What a delicious surprise.
Yeah. I mean, I went into menopause early. So I went into menopause when I was 41. And your body does change really dramatically. And your desire wanes 100%. Hormones are real.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we can talk about the social construction of gender. We can talk about all that. But hormones are real. And I'm telling you, once my body stopped producing estrogen, a lot of shit happened. A lot of shit went down.
Yeah.
Including waning desire. And you, in some ways, you have to like reframe it. For me, I have to reframe it in order to stop believing that I'm always going to have spontaneous desire. You know, this is where like the research that Emily Nagoski goes over in her book, Come As You Are, that really resonated with me. It's like, I don't have spontaneous desire in the way that I did when I was 20, but there are ways in which I can say, let's do this and get into it. And my arousal builds and things kick in and then the desire's there.
Yep. And being able to just be with what's true instead of losing yourself in the desire to be how things were.
Right? Dawn, being with what's true and what is like the fucking hardest thing ever.
Yeah.
Certainly, I think in this climate in America, being with what is a painful fucking process.
Yep.
Because what is terrifying. It's anxiety producing. It's horrifying. It's inhumane. I mean, being with what is doesn't mean accepting it.
Yeah.
I know that. But wow.
Yeah.
The stuff that's going on and, you know, in this country, forget about in the world. In this country, there are people who are being detained in concentration camps. That's just a fact.
Yep.
And you can't look away from that.
Yeah.
So I think being present and being with what is right now is a challenge on so many levels.
Yeah. And of course, it's going to have an impact on what types of touch we want, how much energy we have for things. You know, I mean, like I want so much more forgiveness for ourselves and our partners, especially when things just feel so difficult to be in. Because, you know, you watch the news cycle for 15 minutes and it's like, I think most people are going to be like, well, I kind of need to escape right now and or cope, not be really open and vulnerable and all the other things.
Oh, I'm wondering what you think about this. I'm hoping you've seen this on social media because it has been around in my feed. So there's like a t-shirt and then, but it's all words. So it's kind of a meme and it says, vote like your sister had an abortion. Vote like your partner is queer. Vote like your parent is trans. Vote like you're an immigrant. Vote like English isn't your first language. Vote like your best friend is undocumented. Okay, so I'm summarizing here, right? I'm summarizing. But what struck me, did you see it?
I haven't.
Okay. So I understand the construction of it,
yeah.
Right? It was all about kind of thinking about having a personal stake in the lives of Black and brown bodies, the lives of disabled folks, the lives of queer and trans folks, the lives of people who are undocumented, who are at this point documented immigrants, who are also under attack in the United States, by the way, just documented immigrants, people who speak a different language, you know, all these different marginalized identities. And so it was like, vote as if blank, vote as if blank, vote as if blank. I'll find it. I'll send it to you. You can like put it on the social media. But what struck me about it was like, I had these really ambivalent feelings about it when I saw it. Like I saw it and I was like, okay, I get where you're going for. But then a part of me felt like, but if you put this in front of a white, cis, rich person,
yeah,
they're going to be like, I don't know any of those people. And that's actually not my reality. Of course, it is their reality because they know someone who's had an abortion, but they don't know that they've had an abortion and all that shit, right?
Yeah.
And they know someone queer, but that person's closeted with them, so they don't know. But it struck me like in this weird way, which is that like, why can't we just be humane?
Right.
Like, why can't we just have the value of people's lives have value regardless of their lives, their lived experience, and their identities, which could be farthest from me as they are?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I shouldn't have to understand someone to believe that they are a human being deserving of respect and basic human rights. Right.
Yeah. Like, you don't have to be pro-choice.
Right.
You don't have to know someone or that's had an abortion, know someone who's made any kind of reproductive choice, or yourself be that person to just say, I'm pro-choice.
Yep.
I just wondered if you saw it and what you thought of it.
I haven't, but I 100% agree with what you're saying. Like, I don't need to know. I mean, there's lots of kinds of people in the world that I probably don't know, but right. I still don't want them
stripped of their rights
and taken away from their families right. and potentially dying. You know, I mean, like, none of those things are true. And I think part of the like ideology underneath that is even though it will be hard and it will hurt and it does hurt in so many ways, like, I want to give up some of the things that I have because I believe there is enough in this world for all of us to have enough. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, just from a foundational perspective, you know, there's a lot of people who don't believe that to be true. So they want to hoard the things because they're afraid that we're going to run out, and we will because people are hoarding the things. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, like, I think that the shirt, that meme is kind of trying to get people to care when what people are really grasping for is power and resources.
Yeah.
Right. And a belief that all of these people are taking away their power and resources. And so it feels like a personal attack.
Okay. But also, I love this word hoarding.
Yeah.
Because I don't even think that we should talk about billionaires. I don't even think billionaire should be the word.
Oh, I don't either.
I think people who are billionaires are hoarding money and resources.
Yes.
And that is how they should be referred to. Because no one needs that much money.
No.
No one needs that many resources. No one needs that many houses. They are hoarding money.
Yeah.
And that is how we should refer to them, not as this sort of like neutral term of, oh, well, they're just a billionaire or they're a multimillionaire. No, they're hoarding money.
Yes.
They're hoarding money.
Yes. And causing harm.
I'm here for the hoarding.
Yeah, me too.
I'm glad that you used that word.
Yeah. No, more sharing, less hoarding, more sharing.
More interdependence and just yes. Come on.
Yes.
You don't need that much. God.
Fact. Well.
Jeff Bezos.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos.
I'm sorry.
Warren Buffett.
No, just like, well, at least Warren Buffett's like trying to get other rich people to behave yeah. and giving away a lot of his money.
Yeah, but still, it's not enough.
But like Jeff Bezos is just
disgusting.
He's the epitome of capitalism. I mean, yeah. he's exploiting the most vulnerable workers, but he's also created a monopoly in that there are times when I'm like, where will I get this if not on Amazon? And then I'm like grappling with like, I don't want to support Amazon. Like, I boycotted on Prime Days and all that shit. But then he's made it so that everything is on Amazon. So how do we get some of the things that we need?
Mm-hmm. And when you have certain kinds of disabilities where you're not able to leave the house or go right. shopping for yourself, it's right. literally the only option.
Right.
Like from a survival perspective.
Exactly.
And like
what groceries. I mean, they're doing yeah. groceries.
Right.
And for some people, that's the only way to get groceries is to have someone bring them to the house.
Desiree Attaway shared some statistics the other day, who's an amazing racial justice advocate. And I don't remember all of the numbers, but essentially it was, here are CEOs and how much more per hour they make than their employees. And the top one was the Gap CEO. The Gap CEO makes 3,566 times more money than their line employees. And I did the math. If Gap employees are making $15 an hour, the CEO is making $51,000 an hour. That's 35, 66 times 15.
Right.
No one needs to make $51,000 an hour.
Nope.
No one.
Nope. Okay. I found the shirt.
Oh, great.
Can I just read it to you so that maybe you can give me your take on it?
Yes.
Okay. Vote as if your skin is not white, your parents need medical care, your friend is a missing Indigenous woman, your spouse is an immigrant, your land is on fire, your son is transgender, your house is flooded, your sister is a victim of gun violence, your brother is gay, your water is unsafe, your daughter is a sexual assault survivor.
It's like you said, like, I get the sentiment, and these things are true for so many people. Mm-hmm. But I also think there are so many people who are so far from this being their truth that their stories and prejudice are going to override the sentiment, right? Like, if I have stories about what Indigenous people are, and they're not kind stories because they fit the stereotypes, then my reaction to that is going to be, but I would never be friends with someone like that. Right.
Right.
And like, my house.
Why are they missing? Where do they go to?
Right.
What kind of nonsense did they get wrapped up in?
Right.
You know, these like excuses we make, right?
Right. Or like, if my sister was a victim of gun violence, if I'm a middle-class white person, then I probably have a lot of faith in the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And so my reaction to that is going to be like, well, then we'll get the bad guy.
We'll put the bad guy away.
Right. Right. And so like, I mean, I think the sentiment's kind of like, you know, treat your neighbor like yourself, or kind of mm-hmm. the golden rule. But I think we've seen that that fails because we don't have, there's too many of us that don't have relationships with people that are significantly different from us.
Right.
Right. And so like, if I fundamentally don't understand what it's like to be poor, which the Bessie Davoses of the world have no fucking idea, mm-hmm. that I'm not going to be able to imagine that. So my empathy doesn't get triggered.
But do you need to imagine it to have empathy?
Oh,
that's the thing. Do you need to imagine it? Or can you just know that you want people to have safe water?
Right. And I think that's what I'm more interested in, is instead of trying to trigger this false sense of empathy, like, I just really want, like, do human beings deserve to live lives that are safe, that have access to, you know, basic food and water and a roof over their head? And if your answer to that is it depends on the person, then no amount of empathy begging is going to get you to understand what I'm hoping for, right?
Yeah, no, you honed in on it. It's about empathy. So yeah. So this is sort of trying to solicit a kind of empathy that humans don't all have.
Yeah. And maybe they have, but for whatever reason, it's become buried or mm-hmm. blocked by trauma.
Or the fear of resources and the fear of losing is overriding it.
Right.
Like you said, like the, right. their own fears about losing their job, losing their healthcare, losing their homes, overrides it.
Right. And all of it is fed by all of our stories of pull yourself up by your bootstraps and the hyper-individualism, because mm-hmm. we've been taught that we should be able to fix all the things ourselves and provide for ourselves. And so there's no space in the imagination of so many Americans specifically of, well, what if I did lose my job? And what if I did lose my house? And the community coming together and me not having to be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't have to do it alone, right? Like, that's just not even within the imagination of so many people.
Well, because we've gotten away from this idea of living in, you know, groups of people, multi-generational households, the white sort of European colonial model is, I've always thought this was amazing. It's like everyone has to have like their own washing machine and dryer. Like that's a thing in like middle-class America, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, but what if like four people shared a washer and a dryer?
Yeah.
They had their own houses. They had a laundry room. They had space for it, but everyone doesn't need it if they all live within a block of each other.
Yep. Mind blown for so many people.
Well, it's just this sense of interdependence and also this, but capitalism sort of thrives on us all having our quote unquote own stuff.
Right.
When there are things I think that we don't all individually need to have.
Yeah.
To survive and even thrive. I mean, I don't do laundry every day.
Right.
So like, I don't need to be, you know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know why I thought of that. Maybe because I have to do laundry. I don't
know. But you've got your own washing machine and dryer. So,
but when my washer was broken, we did our laundry at our next door neighbors. And I was like, this isn't that bad. You don't have to carry it that far. You can take it out of the dryer. You don't have to fold it. You just come home and fold it. It's really right next door.
Yeah. Yep.
Anyway.
Well, I would love for you to share with everyone how they can support your Patreon for your memoir and stay in touch with you and find out about all the cool things that you're doing in the world.
My Patreon is simple. It's patreon.com/TristanTaramino. And there's all sorts of levels. So it starts at $2. It's super affordable. And then as the levels go up, you get lots of cool perks like a shout out on my podcast or presents from me or even phone calls with me. So they can check it out. And I appreciate every single one of my Patreons. I'm also on social media. I do my own social media and I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Tristan Taramino. I'm very active on Instagram. So if people want to sort of engage me, that is the best place to do it. Because Instagram, I just like Instagram. I don't know why. I'm grooving with Instagram right now. That may change. My not safe for work website is puckerup.com. My safe for work website is TristanTaramino.com. They can listen to my podcast, Sex Out Loud, wherever they get their podcasts. If you want a direct link to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, you can go to sexoutloudradio.com, sexoutloudradio.com. My sex educator bootcamp, sexeducatorbootcamp.com. Dawn had a huge hand in that. That like website wouldn't exist. They can sign up for my newsletter. And I'm out and about in the world, so they can also maybe see me in their hometown.
Yes. Definitely get to a Tristan workshop if you haven't already, because they are super fun. I will have all of those links on the website, sexgetsreal.com, and in the show notes for this episode so that you can follow Tristan all the places and check out her super cute dogs.
Yes.
And also the super sexy things that she gets up to. And Tristan, thank you so much for coming on the show and absolutely giving me the best brain sex of the day.
I mean, I don't even know how you're going to like you're going to say what the show is about.
It's just going to be Dawn and Tristan talk about everything.
Okay. Because we did hit on a lot of things. There's not maybe an overarching theme. I don't know how you're going to pull that out, but just magic. Okay. We just talk about everything. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. Thank you for being here. And to everybody who tuned in, thank you so much. Of course, feel free to write into the show with your own questions, thoughts, comments. I would love that. And Tristan and I are going to go do a quick little conversation, hopefully, for Patreon. So if you support the show, patreon.com/SGR podcast, and we will see you there. Bye.
You used to light up like a spark. Now you're blue. Treading water in the dark.
A huge thanks to the vocal few, the married duo behind the music featured in this week's intro and outro. Find them at vocalfew.com. Head to patreon.com/sexgetsreal to support the show and get awesome weekly bonuses. As you look towards the next week, I wonder, what will you do differently that rewrites an old story, revitalizes a stuck relationship, or helps you to connect more deeply with your pleasure?
So don't be ashamed. Love is supposed to be